Okay, so today we are going to talk about experimental designs. And this is, we are not going to cover a lot of things today, but instead we are going to do it very intensively, many times. So this is actually something that I'd like that you can be very automatic with. You can see certain things when you see the research design. This is the dependent variable here, and this is actually not controlled very well, and so forth. Oh, by the way, how many of you did read the Eggerstein and Wilson paper? With care. All right, we'll get back to that in a moment. But so, the ability to construct and design an experiment is a very fundamental skill of a scientist. And if you're not going to be a scientist in your life, it's good to be able to pick up the crucial information about how something was done in order for you to be able to assess the results of the paper. So my task today is to go through this like many, many times. My part will be this first three lectures, this very basic stuff of everything. And then Jarmo Hämäläinen and Simon Monto will tell you more detailed things about what to do with the brain signals. You'll do some source localization, MATLAB analysis from the command line, all kinds of fun stuff. Okay. Today, I'll give you a quick update on our labs, because you probably noticed that there are a big change going on. And then we get to the real core subject of today, the experimental research designs. Then we're going to go through this paper, and then I'll give you some assignment that we can start doing here, so you can discuss your ideas and I can help you with that. And by the way, we're going to have the first session here, then we have lunch, and then the later session in the A building, MAA. That's because I could not book a 4-hour slot in a single place in the university. So, what you can do within the University of Jyväskylä in terms of neuroscience? Well, this is probably the most obvious part, and I think many of you have some experience with recording EEG. Actually, how many of you have been recording? More than a half, I think. Nowadays we have one functioning EEG lab in the Kärki building. It was just moved there last week. But there will be three of them, three high density. That high density means that they have capability of recording 128 channels at a time. And they will be ready in March. This is just so that you know that you can be a part of these kind of things if you want. Then we have the MEG, that's fully operational by now. Many of you have been there too. And you probably know that the schedule of MEG is fully booked, so it's in really intensive use. But that's the other option of doing that kind of recording, functional recordings in the living brain non-invasively in our university. Well, this is something that relates to the subject matter of the course that we are going through. We are going to give you a, we are trying to give you a, an overview of what you do when you have the raw data and then you have some have the result. It's not very obvious that we are recording from a certain part of the brain in a certain frequency. And then they said, we all have seen those nice figures of a brain with the colored blob saying that something happens here. But getting there is actually a tedious process involving lots of sub-steps. So this is something that we are trying to go through during this course. I'll do it in a very simple way, and then Jarmo will take it to the more complicated level. We have the possibility to stimulate the brain and modulate the brain function by TMS. They are in the health science department, but we do have three of different devices to do the TDC, transcranial direct current stimulation. This is something that I have been involved with in the recent year or so. And by the way, if someone would like to participate on this either as a subject or as an experimenter, contact me, because I need some help with this too. By the way, how many of you will be there today discussing about SIBA 140, neuroscience practice? Marianne, okay. I sent email to everyone who was enrolled to this CIBA 140 neuroscience practicum. We're going to meet today after this session.
Sorry, when is that
business time?
Right after?
Yeah, I would like 13:30. Maybe we are half. We should be quite done by that. Okay, that's what it looks like in effect if we had just have a two channel stimulation and idling conditioning going on in this case. It doesn't feel like much, but there is a, you can see that there is a bumps in this guy's head, but they aren't bumps, they are the electrodes delivering the transcranial direct current stimulation. So in this case we are trying to enhance this fellow's activity in the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. Quite successfully, I would say, actually. So we'll skip that. Then we of course have these animal research facilities where we can record behavior, like learning, temperament, stuff like that. But we can also do these deep intracranial recordings, which I have been talking about in another course. So let's not spend time with these. Okay, let's also a quick update on the labs, which are about to move right now. But if you want to be involved in some form of research activity, just contact me if you want to do a project of your... Well, if you're interested in doing anything with those, just let me know about it. But we'll see if you can get some credits about it. All right. So now, to the really basics of experimental design. This is the very essence of science, actually. And those of you who have studied psychology have seen this so many times, but still, try to go through this once more. So let's have a look at what do we mean by theory, what is a hypothesis, how do we measure something, and why, and what are the problems, and then a word or two about using about controlling the experiments. These are not trivial things, even though they are very, you have seen these concepts many times. But it so happens every now and then that when I read a manuscript of it, when I am, well, you know this reviewer process. Scientists send their stuff to the papers, and papers send them to the other side for the peer review, and then we get to read stuff that hasn't yet been published so that we could assess whether they have been done correctly. And it's actually quite surprising to see how often it is that there are some obvious shortcomings, even mistakes in how the experiments were designed. Meaning that the result that someone has had, well, we can believe that it was done correctly and that actually happened. No one is usually questioning that. But it's quite often the case that you can actually explain that result by something else than by what they had been doing. And that's usually because the experiment wasn't controlled very well. So we'll have a look at those things. And yeah, this happens a lot among the scientists, and it happens even more among the students. So we are trying to make this automatic now, so that you can construct a, you can see the possible caveats and shortcomings automatically when you see the experimental design. Okay, what is a theory? Theory is something that guides what you are doing. It doesn't necessarily need to be true. So this is one unique features of science, that we are not claiming that we are dealing with the truth. Because every theory could basically be falsified. So if it fails to predict the results correctly, we have to ditch the theory. And this has happened a lot. I'm not saying that I understand anything about physics, but you have probably seen in the news that something that Einstein said about more than 100 years ago was just kind of not proved, but verified. Okay, his theory sustained that test. But it has happened many times during the history of science that some theory has worked very well, like Isaac Newton's theory about how things move and are related to each other. Well, that's basically fundamentally wrong, but it explains a lot of things that happen. So it's very useful, because it's very simple. It's not even half that complicated than Einstein's theory about relativity, which I just don't understand at all. But Newtonian physics is, well, not easy, but easier to conceive. But there's something fundamentally wrong with it in terms of universal science, or universal physics. And the same applies in neuroscience and psychology in general. We don't know whether our theories are true in a very strict sense of the word. But they evolve, and that actually is something that makes the distinction between science and something else. Like in pseudoscience, we are not trying to falsify our theories. We are trying to find something that back them up. In order for something to be a useful theory, it has to predict something. It has to do a pretty good job in predicting something. But it has one feature that has to be there. It has to be, there has to be a way to prove that it's wrong. And this is the principle of falsifiability. So, if you think about these theories, let's look at the first one. If I had a theory that the surface of the dark side of the moon is cheese, would you say that this is a good theory? Well,
what are you based on this? Why do you say this?
I mean, do you think that this is a valid scientific theory?
Yes.
Yes, it is. It's stupid, of course, but it's valid because we can actually check how things are. We can, in principle, prove that that is wrong. We can send some kind of a rocket to the dark side of the moon and pick a rock there and, oh, that's not cheese.
Can we develop the hypothesis?
Yeah. This is a slippery, this is a very vague distinction between these two. A hypothesis would say that if we took a sample of the surface of that, it would not be cheese. Because then we are making a very specific prediction. That's actually a theory, but yeah, I agree. This is something that's just... I wasn't too strict with that one. How about this? It's possible to read someone else's thoughts. Is it a good scientific theory? Again, just ignore the facts and everything, but the question is, could I prove that wrong or not? Well, it's easy to make a test that actually proves this wrong. You can make a hypothesis that someone is thinking of something, and if this someone else cannot tell what he's thinking, then it's not possible. So it's a good scientific theory. It's a bit shaky, but still, it's a good theory. How about pyramids were built by space aliens? Now we are on the brink of... Well, basically, you could draw some hypotheses about this. If the pyramids were built by space aliens... Yeah, there should be all kinds of consequences of this theory. There should be some marks of aliens. But if everything points to the fact that they were built by slaves, then it's kind of a... We can find evidence that runs counter to that. So basically that's okay-ish theory. Oh, by the way, do you know this ancient alien kind of things that you can see in these Waste of Time TV channels? They are my favorite. How about the world was created by a flying spaghetti monster? Is that a good scientific theory? Of course, you can replace the flying spaghetti monster with whatever you want, but can you disprove that? There's no way of doing that. If someone believes that, you cannot just make an experiment that would prove that this is not the case. So this is the kind of a what a theory, good theory is and what is not. Some say that psychoanalysis is something somewhere in a vague border of such things, because you can't really say that it's false, because you just can't conceive an experiment that would prove that it's wrong. But yeah, lots of science is not either that or that. There are some many stuff that lots of stuff that is somewhere in between. Okay, but the theory, the point, the bottom line here is that the theory is something, a good scientific theory is something that you can test. You can, according to the theory, you can draw a hypothesis that you can actually study whether that's true or not. Theory should predict something. Well, hypothesis is something that is very well defined. It's a well-defined prediction of what's going to happen according to that theory. If a brain structure X is involved in, well, let's say that if the medial temporal lobe has something to do with memory, then if we made a lesion to medial temporal lobe, that would actually disrupt memory. It wouldn't prove that the theory is right, but it would basically prove that it's wrong if the memory was not affected by a lesion in the medial temporal lobe. There are one and two directional hypotheses we usually deal with. At least in statistics, we rely on two directional tests, or two tailed tests. So one directional hypothesis would have something would increase if I did this, or decrease. The two directional hypothesis would have something would change if I did this. There is a difference between these two groups. One directional hypothesis is that this group would be taller than people in the other group. And then there's no hypothesis which states that the observed difference between the conditions of groups is just there by chance. There's always some degree of difference between two measures that you do. Whether or not that is there by chance, or because of your manipulations or some pre-existing feature between these groups, is a matter of statistics. But if you run an experiment and you the basic result is that whatever you saw could be there by chance, then we have to retain the null hypothesis that there is. It's not such an effect, or the theory is wrong. Or it might actually tell us that we did something wrong. There was something wrong in our experimental designs. It happens a lot in science that someone, some group, does an experiment and gets a result that's not predicted by a theory. But science is also very conservative. We are not going to ditch the theory because of one observation that kind of disproves it. Because we are humans, and when we do experiments, we do mistakes, and we are not that good at all times, we are not that certain that we did things right. So it's actually very common that I believe that this happens, then I run an experiment, it didn't happen. But the first thing I do is not to believe that my belief was wrong. But I just go back to the lab and maybe I just didn't do it right. Maybe these parameters won't give me that result. Because sometimes you have to really do the same experiment many times in order to have an effect. We have to find the right parameters of an experiment. And then, this is very important for us. We do have variables. And in psychology and neuroscience, they are not that, it's not that simple. So, we have this case here. Mary has 1,000 euros on her bank account, and Matthew's account balance is minus 50 euros. The question is now, does Mary have more money than Matthew? What would you say? Yes, that's probable. But how about if Matthew had $2,000 euros in his wallet? He doesn't trust banks. But basically you're right. But you're not all right. Because however we are going to measure something, we get a very limited view on that phenomena. In this case, we were interested in how much money these people have. And we, okay, maybe if we had a look at what they have on their bank accounts, that will actually tell us how much money they have. Well, it's true. Rich people usually have more money in their bank accounts than poor people. So it's fairly reasonable to assume that Mary has more money than Matthew. But it's not certain, because Matthew could have the money somewhere else. And by the way, we are going to do something freshening in a bit, so let's go through this down in the class first. Well, this is an important distinction. What kind of variables do we have? We have independent variables and we have dependent variables. How we call them is not important, but it's important to get the meaning that there is a variable that affects something and a variable that we are measuring. An independent variable is the factor of and by the way, if you want to ask me questions in Finnish, you are free to do that if you don't know how to formulate your what you have in mind in English. An independent variable, riippumaton muuttuja, is the factor that causes the change in the dependent variable. So, independent variable could be something that we manipulate people with. Let's say that we are interested in how a certain drug affects the headache. And then we have people who have a headache, we give them that drug, or we don't give them that drug. So this treatment becomes an independent variable. It's dichotomous. No drug or drug. Or it could be something that we are interested in. A trivial example would be that there's some pre-existing feature making a distinction between two groups. Let's say that men and women. We have a hypothesis that, or a theory, that men are taller than women. Kind of trivial thing, but in this case, gender of the participant would be the independent variable. And the dependent variable is the thing that we actually measuring or recording. If we have an ERP response, and its amplitude would be a dependent variable of an experiment. We are playing a subject with we are presenting the subject with certain tones, and we are recording his or her responses to them, and then we somehow tamper with tones. Something funny going on every now and then. And what happens in the ERP amplitude would be the thing that we record, and that would be the dependent variable. This can be, dependent variables could be within subject changes or between subject changes. Within subject would be something that we record from the same person many times. Like, let's say, before a treatment and after the treatment. And then between subjects would be an experiment where we would have two groups. Let's say that in this men versus women example, they would of course be between subjects recordings. But we'll get back to this in soonish. Another thing, operationalization. Correctly in English. That means that this is a very crucial thing in neuroscience, and especially in psychology. What would you say about this? How would you measure that? Who thinks that that's absurd? Come on. I think it's absurd. But in operationalization, we try to convert something that we are interested in into something that we can measure or record. How about operationalizing love? Well, in a common parlance, I think it's reasonable to say in a family fight that you don't love me as much as you used to. Maybe that's a valid sentence there. But if you're a scientist, well, come on, how would you measure that? Prove that. Of course, we could do. We could convert this into something that we could record, like how many roses would Matti bring to Maija per week? And we could see that there's a decline over the years. But does it tell that love has gone or decreases? No, but perhaps not. Maybe this is something that we should not be bothered with. Of course, you're free to try. If you can find a neural correlate of love, we are going to have a very high impact paper in this university, so feel free to try. But yeah, that's close to impossible. But this kind of underlines the problem that we have at hand. In psychology, there's lots of very elusive concepts, like intelligence, anger. We just can't measure them by putting a person into a brain scanner. Oh, by the way, how would you measure anger? You got any suggestions?
Arousal?
Yeah, I assume you mean physiological recordings. Yeah. Yeah, okay, that's a valid point. Except that if you just that, arousal can actually be heightened due to many different reasons than anger. So maybe we should have some kind of a multimodal assessment. Anger is, we have anger when someone's arousal is heightened and he or she swears a lot per minute. Yeah.
But couldn't you also do the same with love, for example? Love, if you think about it as a cultural concept, Amber has also another meaning in that, as he also put it in the, for example, family surroundings, so that you just have to find your variables.
Yeah, of course, you could, yes. But it's very difficult. I mean, love, I would say it's still maybe a couple of clicks towards more difficult classes. Especially if you want to say something that someone loves someone else more than the other one. So it's very hard to say something about that in a numerical format. Anger is maybe something that you could actually describe by a number. In psychology, we have lots of this self-assessment stuff that there's a scale ranging from 0 to 7, like a Likert scale. Well, it's just a 10-centimeter bar, and the subject has to put across, like, here is I'm not excited at all, and here is I'm overly excited. So where is the your current status assessed by yourself? But this really is the very fundamental problem in psychology and in neuroscience. Because whenever we are measuring something, we want to be sure that what we are measuring would actually tell us something about the target of interest. And it's not that obvious that it happens. We are recording brain responses to sounds, and then we are saying that this tells us something about memory. Could be, but it could also be stemming from some other explanation. And as I said, it's easy in, let's say, physics or physiology itself. It's quite easy. Temperature of a person. We can put a thermometer in someone's office and record that. That's very valid.